What's in store for your business this week at Staples?
Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.
The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hey.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good. This is Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Good. How you doing, man?
So is everybody else there?
Everybody else being Marcus and then Crank. We're all here.
So how you doing, guys?
All right. That's okay.
Yeah, I heard Marcus.
Got you on speakerphone, so.
How'd you do after all those bouts with the flu?
Yeah, doing better. It was crazy. I was sick for what seemed like 2 or 3 months straight.
I know. We're trying to get back in November, I think. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, it has not been a very good season for me.
Yeah, you got to watch that, man. You got to take care of yourself. Those golden tones, you don't want to lose them.
I've been trying to tell him that for the past 20 years.
So how's the weather out there tonight?
Oh, well, we had snow most of the day, but it stopped now.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm shoveling elderly people's driveways and sidewalks. Actually, I'm not tired of doing it because I don't mind doing it, but.
All right, so you guys all set?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I wish I could get this phone a little bit louder, but just be gracious with in case we have to have you repeat something on it.
All right, so if you're ready, I guess I'll get rolling.
Okay, cool.
Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, horror punk meets spaghetti western with the Vladimir side project Sono Mori on the Big Pop Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, we feature return engagement with a twist. Last summer, we had on one of my all-time favorite punk bands, Vladimir's. Perhaps the most unusual and interesting of several bands and side projects the guys have going, shows this very different side than the ones fans of the group are used to hearing. While 3 of the 4 members of the band take part in this project, this is a different matter entirely, a dark, brooding soundtrack for a horror movie that never was. Their self-titled debut record is an unusual and extremely atmospheric musical venture, tapping equally into the more haunting strains of old-school country western, the eerie soundscapes of Ennio Morricone, and the more mournful moments of Danzig, Southern Death Cult, and Nick Cave. And for those who are still up on their comic book culture, the current EP is based on and ties into an interesting new indie comic series called Revival, which has been described in terms of its very own genre of farm noir. Join us tonight for another entertaining and informative conversation with Marquis, Brian, and Crank of the Vladimir's as we talk Sono Morti, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we talk about how the project came together, the various musical influences that are being referenced in their sound, and some philosophy on music per se. But before we get into all that, here's a song off Revival. This is Condemned.
This is a place of hopelessness and fear, and I don't think we're getting out of here. The light is dim, the path is overgrown, where we've ended at no one could know. Reason why sadly fades, who we were slips away. Shadows roam these old deserted roads, searching for the light that let them go. The secret seal hid
Listen, as the Third Eye, I may recall a few months back, I had on one of my favorite punk bands, and certainly my favorite punk band of the modern era, the Vladimirs. During the interview, it was mentioned a few times that most of the members of the band were also involved in another project. Today, I have Brian Day, guitar and some vocals, Marcus Thomas, main vocalist, and Crank, who provides bass, cover art, and conceptual inspiration for both bands, here to discuss a more unusual, very atmospheric musical venture, one that taps equally into the more haunting strains of old-school country western like Johnny Cash, the eerie soundscapes of Ennio Morricone, and the more mournful moments of Danzig or Southern Death Cult. And for those who are still up in their comic book culture, the current EP is based on and ties into an interesting new indie comic series that's being described in terms of its very own genre. Today we're talking Sono Morti. Guys, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you debuted in 2008 with the Sono Morti album. Now, the first thing I have to ask is, are you aware that the actual Italian translation isn't We Are the Dead, which is what I suspect you were shooting for, but I died?
It was something like, there was a longer phrase that I had a friend, an Italian friend, translate for me. And it was something like, I'm going to slaughter the accent on this, but it was something like, Epoche di Sono Morte or something like that. The idea I was trying to get across was for those who had died, shorten it to Sono Morte.
Well, it sounds better that way. I was just like, well, that's kind of funny. You probably don't even realize that. 2/3 of the Vladimirs take parts in Sono Morte, so why not Ash? And since it's never mentioned, who's actually doing drums on this project?
Actually, it's kind of funny because I said right before we called you, I said, it's kind of weird to do this interview without Ash. And then I said, well, he's not in the band. And I was like, he could be. Crank played drums on both projects, actually. The both releases. The first one and the most recent one.
So bass and drums, huh? Double duty.
The answer to the question why Ash isn't involved is just, I really don't have an answer for that, other than it was just the three of us sitting here coming up with the stuff. He never came over for any of it, and I don't mean it was never anything where it was kind of weird, or it was just kind of like a side thing we started doing, which is weird because we first all talked about this. At one point, all four of us worked at the same print shop together. When the first idea to do this came up was when, what, like, was that 99, 2000 maybe?
Somewhere around. You talked about wanting to do a Vladimir's Western album.
Yeah, it was originally going to be Vladimir's Western, but then it just escalated into more and more stuff, and Chris finally is the one who resurrected it down, was that, like, 06 or something like that? When we were like, oh, let's just finally do this. And at the time, Chris was up in Chicago, so Brian and I drove up there a weekend, and we banged a big hunk of that first release out up there with him, and then we finished it up a couple months later back down here in Cincinnati. But just Ash, I mean, he just never happened. And like I said, it was nothing weird. It just, he just was never involved in it, really.
I seem to remember at the time, I think Ash had a lot going on, too.
But he was probably touring with Estuary, I would bet, man.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing, it basically was, like they were saying, it basically was like a slowly building process, because if you remember back on The Odds Are Against Us, I wrote the song Bare Hands, which blatantly stands out on that album. And really, that was sort of where that whole thing started. The band didn't start there, but the idea.
The idea.
We started with So Fine, Dark Day.
Oh, yeah, Dark Day.
A little bit, but that's a little bit different, too.
We even talked about, in the inception of Sono Morte, we actually talked about covering Dark Day, I think.
I really wanted to, but we just never did.
Yeah, and Bare Hands would have definitely fit right in on either Sono Morti album. But, you know, it's just strange because usually when people say, okay, I've got a side project going, it's one member, maybe two, but it's like almost the entire band except him. So, like, what's going on?
Very incestuous in that way, I guess. We're sort of like, we work well together and we all have so broad of interests that if I say I want to do like a 70s prog, or say like a 70s trippy kind of thing, like I know Marcus would be down for that and he'd be good for that, and I know Chris would be on board, so I don't really have to leave my intimate circle of friends to accomplish any of my projects, you know. I think it's kind of like the same with all of us. Like, we were like, hey, let's do a techno thing, like Crank might say. Let's do like a weird, well, I mean, we're actually working on another project right now. So Crank's like, hey, let's do like a kind of a stoner thing. And I'm like, yeah, I'm down with that, you know. So it's like, we don't really have to recruit anybody, which is kind
of
cool.
It's funny, too, because all of us individually, when we all talk, we all have like tons of ideas. It's funny to see which ones come to fruition. It's just, this just happens to be one of the ones that we actually got something done on.
So at the time, when we first were working on the first album, I wasn't in the Vladimirs until 2008.
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, when we first started working on it, I wasn't in the band, so it was only half the band that was...
Yeah.
But it was still your idea initially, right?
I mean, it's complicated, but yeah, I guess.
It was all talked about, and if Chris hadn't brought it up and actually brought something to the table to refine it and us actually say, there's something to do, it wouldn't have got done if Chris hadn't been like, hey, guys, we need to do this. And if I found it, would have been one of those things like, why didn't we ever do that?
And just to tap into one other thing you were saying, would it be possible even to perform this stuff live without recruiting somebody like Ash? Because, you know, how are you going to do it if you're playing bass and drums? You're going to sit there with the bass on your lap and the drumstick in one hand.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to experiment. You can tell them, Chris.
Oh, sorry, I was just laughing at myself, like in one of those old outfits with a bass drum strapped to my back.
I have a Bill Ward solo album. He's got like every instrument.
Like a one man.
We've never actually played any of this stuff live. It was one of those things where I guess we just haven't gotten around to it.
We worked on it for a minute. Chris Crank took the drum tracks and put them like a MP3 or whatever, and we played it through the PA in the practice room, and I think we had one practice where all of us were playing it to basically a glorified click track, I guess you'd say. I don't know what happened, why that fell apart. Probably the same reason that Vladimir stuff takes forever to get done. I mean, we just got an offer today, actually, to do acoustic set, so I'm always down for it. I'd go see Marcus if Marcus just did it by himself. I think one of the things about Sono Morte may be that it doesn't require drums per se, I wouldn't think, you know, like
that's true.
It could come off without, you know, just acoustic and a bass or something, I don't know.
Yeah, I figured if us sat down to do it, it would be good to probably have it stripped down where we all
that's
just...
That's actually what I was thinking, you know, just a couple of you guys sitting there, you don't even need a bass, you can just do like three acoustic guitars or something.
Or two acoustics and a keyboard.
Yeah, keyboard's kind of crucial, I think.
But other than Bare Hands, which was a good point, that actually does fit right in. The first album is very different from what you're doing in the Vlads. I mean, this is really tapping into the sort of iconography that I actually hadn't heard anyone tackle since the days of Adam and the Ants on Kings of the Wild Frontier or early Wall of Voodoo. I mean, you got like Morricone Western soundtrack music, the more haunting side of Johnny Cash, like Ghost Riders in the Sky, and this peculiar iconography that harkens back to the American Old West, but taps into something very different at the same time. You know, the same skewed lens that the Italians saw that period through, or the British New Wave did, being outside and looking in. So what inspired this?
You're going to get several different answers, so I'll let Marcus go first.
Well, I would say everything you said there was pretty much spot on.
I like the Wall of Voodoo reference.
It definitely first started out as an idea of let's do music that's kind of like spaghetti western mixed with like actual songs, to where, like, you know, with verse and chorus, where it's kind of, you know, western gothic, southern gothic kind of thing. It just escalated into all of our different influences coming in, and like I said, everything you said there is, I 100% agree with.
Yeah, I mean, you could technically even toss Nick Cave in there, thinking about southern gothic.
Most definitely. I am a huge Nick Cave fan. Birthday Party, Bad Seed stuff, I love. And I really love Leonard Cohen also.
I draw heavily. I touch probably 30% on what Marcus said. I mean, I do like that stuff, and most of that stuff was probably introduced to me through Marcus or maybe my wife, like, you know, The Church and Echo and the Bunnymen, just old goth, like the Bolshoi, stuff like that, like bands like 80s goth rock bands. Spooky pop, yeah, something with an eerie feel. I guess probably more like 60% of what I listen to, or where I draw from, is 70s prog or 70s psychedelic. Old Fleetwood Mac or old Uriah Heep, you know, like, so I really... I guess that's basically what I bring to it. Or maybe like some Blue Oyster Cult or something. Just, you know, trippy kind
of
stuff.
And you could pick that up in there. There is definitely a prog influence thrown in there in the middle of all this kind of... That's why it's a nice mix. It's like, where's this really all coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I said there's always a common ground between all of us. We just vary as far as how much of that common ground we all share.
I mean, to go back, again, you know, a lot of stuff was sort of germinating well before the project actually started. When I lived in Chicago, I was hung out with people I worked with. We were you know, comic book people. It was me and my friend Tim Seeley, who's a comic writer and artist. We were sitting in a bar just drinking one night, and we started talking about how we liked films like the Ennio Morricone stuff, and we liked the things like and High Plains Drifter. And we started talking about making a movie kind of set in modern Chicago, but right. done like a spaghetti western, being like you don't know whether the person's a ghost or real or what, and they're coming back for a sort of a revenge kind of thing. And we were just talking about that, and that got me thinking about doing a soundtrack for it, because we had already been talking about this stuff back when we all worked together, Brian and Marcus and me. You know, that's when I started thinking about, well, let's go ahead and do this, because I know they're sort of interested in that anyway. Initially, it all kind of sprung from that, I guess.
It's like the soundtrack for a movie that wasn't made kind of deal.
I've always been like a really big fan of Goblin.
Yeah.
And I loved how they would do soundtracks, but they weren't limited to just one style.
Right.
Like, they weird things to fit whatever they were doing.
Yeah, because, I mean, I collect a tremendous amount of Italian soundtracks from the 60s and 70s, and a lot of them are, you get a theme and then just kind of repeat it with variations. That, you know, they'll go through different styles. You might get a samba version, you might get whatever it is, but it's this, yeah, sure, you got like a samba, you got a bossa nova, then you get a straight acoustic version, then you get just a vocal version, you get a proggy version, you know, it's like they cycle this theme through a bunch of different, as it goes on, it's like 20 tracks. But when you get somebody like Goblin, or even to a lesser extent, Guido Maurizio De Angelis, you get that kind of every track is different, or they're at least trying to put different pieces of music in there that they might not have even shown up in the movie for more than a couple seconds, but it's not just, okay, let's just keep doing that like Beethoven, Bach kind of thing, or okay, we got that theme, let's do another variation, let's do another variation, let's do another variation. And if they've got another idea in their head, they save it for the next movie. You know, these guys are just like, let me lay this out like it's a record album.
They approached it as it was a full-scale record. They didn't care where it was going to end up in the movie, like if the whole thing would get in there. They were
exactly.
actually writing an album, which was, that's a great idea.
I was always super impressed at the fact that, you know, they managed to pull off so many different styles, but they made it all coherent. It all, like, it belonged together. That was sort of another idea with the Son of Morte thing, was that, yeah, we're starting off this first thing, we're going for sort of a spaghetti western feel, but that's not necessarily what it's always
going to
be.
Yeah, it's not limited to that. You had a lot of other stuff going on in there, which, again, makes it more interesting. It's not just that same old, okay, here's what they're going for, and that's it, they're locked in, which I think you get with a lot of, now there is no such thing anymore, but what used to be considered a mainstream rock band. They just pick a style, and they stick there. You know, this is more like, say, The Cure, where it's like you never knew what the hell you were going to get from track to track or album to album.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I love that. But
it's like we're approaching it sort of like we're approaching it like we're studio musicians, something that needs to be done for whatever the idea is, as opposed
exactly.
to just make another rock album or something.
It's very impressionistic, your sound. I can see dust storms, tumbleweeds, bare trees rustling in the wind, that kind of thing. It's very much an album geared towards, well, this time of year when I had originally planned to do this, fall, Halloween, the whole deal. You get these mental images popping out. I'm going to play what I can, but I actually wish I could play the whole album and EP here, because they're extremely atmospheric, and it's more akin to a 70s, like we were talking about, a 70s album-oriented thing rather than a song-oriented one, like most music is nowadays. So it's hard to pick what tracks will work best and what stands out from the other ones. It's kind of all of a piece. It's got a lot in common with soundtrack music, like we were saying.
Right. I'm glad that you feel that way, because that's basically you're edifying what I think all of us were going for, so that's good.
So, Brian, you actually seem to be taking a fair share of the vocals here, much more than generally is the case with the Vladimir. So why is that?
I guess just because I envision Marcus singing the songs that I wrote. And if I sing on it, I wrote it, basically. And I wanted him to sing the parts, but he... The only reason I've sung any song, be it Son of Morte or Vladimir, the only reason I ever sung was because Marcus said that he either didn't want to or couldn't. He didn't feel right singing it for some reason.
Well, as always, to me, is Brian's got such a great voice, and when he's singing me the song, saying like, "This is how I want you to sing it," because he's got it done. I'm like,
right.
Well, then you should, because his voice is awesome. So it shouldn't be like, well, I should just sing it just because. And I always just like, well, he wrote it and he can sing it, so I'll just maybe play guitar back here while you're, especially with Son of Morte. Like you said, when you introduced us, you said lead vocals, Marcus. Well, I'm guitar and vocals. I'm not always the lead, you know?
Right.
So it's kind of, I'm not, there's really no front man in Son of Morte. It's like us as a unit, like how Chris kind of said, like studio musicians. We do whatever the track needs to do. We come in and do that part if we got an idea, as opposed to going, well, I'm not going to do that part because I'm not really the lead, so the lead guy should do it. But like, no, well, whoever can do it, and if it was their idea, they should do it. that kind
right. of thing. Right. You're meeting the demand of the immediate, here's this problem right here, here's this challenge. Okay, who's going to fit this best and go for it? It's true what you were saying about Brian's vocals, because it's not like, say, the early Yngwie Malmsteen demos where he was singing. You know, he can actually carry a tune. So.
Well, I mean, on which song was that? I can't think of the title. But I can go grab the CD. But it's one of the songs on the first album I wrote, and then I gave Marcus... Sorry, my daughter just came up and gave me a kiss. Oh, yeah, one of the songs, it was the...
Oh, Crimson Rider.
No. Well, Crimson Rider, I wanted you to sing that song. I desperately wanted you to sing that song, but it just did... When you tried, it wasn't working.
No, it sounded way better when you did it.
And I don't even agree with that, but I mean, it just wasn't working when you did it. But
trust me, it was better that you did it.
Okay. Well, there was the Written Blood Red.
That Written Blood Red was the song that had no lyrics. It was supposed to be an instrumental, and I thought you wanted lyrics for it. So when I came in to record it, you were like, what are you doing? I said, well, I wrote the lyrics for this song. And you were like, this isn't supposed to have lyrics. So I sang you what...
Right.
I came up with, and you were like, well, that's cool. So we rearranged the song, because the song was originally, like 2.5 minute
right.
instrumental, and
right.
then we stretched it out to have verses in it.
That's what I was going to say, was like instances like that where he didn't realize that I had a preconceived notion for or against lyrics. Like that, I should write all my songs that I want him to sing. I should just write them with no like preconceived vocal idea, because that song turned out good. And I, you know, it wasn't planned to be that way. Like, if I would have wrote Crimson Rider and just said, here's the music, he may have come up with something completely... And he may have ended up singing that song, which is what I wanted originally.
Right.
But because he heard my vocal ideas, it sort of shut him...
It just sounded... I mean, that wouldn't have been shut me down. I wanted to elevate you to do it, because it sounded better with you doing it.
But that's because you already heard the idea. That's what I'm saying. Like, if I came to you with that song without a vocal idea, you may have come up with something. But since you had already heard my idea...
You're 100% right.
Well, see, I thought you were going to tap into Cumulus Crown, because I was thinking, you know, Marcus wouldn't fit on that, because that is, you got this kind of high tenor going on, and, you know, he's got that deep booming baritone, so it's like, I know that I got a baritone, so if I try to sing that high, I'm really pushing it, it doesn't sound right, you know, that's definitely geared more towards you.
There's no way I could have done that song at all.
Yeah.
I'm still not happy with the vocals on that. I had actually pressed Chris to, like, let me go back and re-record those vocals, because I felt like I wasn't... I don't know. I felt like I was not quite like where I should have been as far as those high notes. But anyway, on that song in particular, I had asked Marcus to like, do some major accompaniment, I guess you'd call it, accompanying vocals. And
right.
he gave it a try, and then he didn't like the takes, so he said, no, he's not going to do it, which I that's fine, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's odd to me, because in the Vladimirs, him and I can mesh. But
right.
in the Sono Morte thing, it's almost like our vision is a whole different thing, so it's hard for us to like mesh vocally, I think, in this.
I just think that with this band, it should be different.
And I agree,
yeah,
that's
you know?
Fine. It should be whatever it ends up being. That's fine, you know. Like, but you know, I originally wanted Marcus to sing Crimson Rider. I really did, because I just don't have. I'm not going to get into.
I'm in there. I'm in there doing some chorus
right.
stuff, but I didn't.
Right.
It sounded better. Oh, sorry. That was a chair.
I was wondering about that when you apologized.
Had a little bit to drink here this evening.
But, you know, I was going to say that you're apologizing a lot for your performance and all this. I'm like, I learned something years ago. I mean, okay, you guys are recording. I haven't recorded anything in many years. But just as a musician, I'll tell you that I've learned years ago, you just got to kind of let it go and hell with it. Because a lot of times the first take or the first attempt that you put into something, that's the one with all the feel. And no matter how many times you redo it and try to perfect it, you lose all that. And it's not freaking worth it. You consider doing 20 takes. And the one you always end up going with is number one or number two. It's like, what the hell with it? Just, all right, so it's got some mistakes in it. So what? You know, just let it go.
Right. You don't realize, you don't know me.
we're all extremely self-analytical to a crippling.
Yeah. I've been there, so that's why I'm saying this. I've learned to, like, let it go. Just, you know, the hell with it.
I've gotten to the point where I don't do demos anymore, because I could, at time when I would do demos, I could never re-record the proper tracks the way
right.
I like in the demos.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I keep calling my head until I'm actually ready to record. And then I'll spend 5 hours doing one part. But so it's not like it's the first take or anything, but it's
right.
I recorded that piece, you know?
Like with
the Vladimir's late hours, there was a whole big turmoil, tumultuous issue of the way that the demos sounded and then trying to recreate that with the actual final product. And it was like almost just, it was.
But did you notice that we demoed maybe a little bit less than half of the album, and the songs we didn't demo, nobody had a problem with.
Right.
We demoed the whole album.
Did we demo like the title track? I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
I must have been drinking a lot that day. I don't even remember that. Oh, I do remember now. That's why
we didn't demo it. We didn't do a full demo of it, but we did.
No, I remember now. When you came over to my house and I did the thigh dig.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I got so accustomed to the way that, like the solos on the demos for Late Hours, I got so accustomed to that, and I started to like dig on those. And then when it came time to do the real solos, I was like, and I can't, whatever that energy was that I did on those demos is not for these like final cuts, and it just drove me nuts. Like
exactly, that's what I'm saying. That's what I always encounter. So I just say, you know, the hell with it. I'll try to edit out parts that are lousy. Like when you hear the show themes, you know, there's parts that didn't work. So I'll like pull this from this solo, I'll pull that from that take, and whatever, mix it together. But you know, basically, what you hear is always most of that stuff. Most of that solo is track one. Or track three, not like track 16.
And
you can even go back to like a pro like Yngwie. I have a rival band, a friend of mine, and he used to complain because he went to see Yngwie once or twice. And he's like, yeah, you know, he doesn't even do his solos like on the record. He just like makes it up on the fly. I'm like, well, yeah, that's the point. You know, you want to see the record? Just pull the record out. You're supposed to, it's like jazz. You're supposed to improvise. You make your own damn, because otherwise you lose all the energy. You lose all the power and you just become like a hits band. You know, it's like a hits tour from the 50s.
Well, I'm glad that you take that perspective because that lightens the load for musicians like us who actually, well, you're a musician too, but I mean, it lightens the load for other musicians who
are still stuck in that perfectionist thing, yeah.
Right, man, because I mean, I'm telling you, like, I really kill myself trying to be perfect with stuff, and like, you know, like you're saying, it may not be necessary all the time.
Well, you know, that's why you aren't hearing about my band. You know, I'll tell you like about it on these interviews, but you aren't hearing us out in a record store, because that was the same way when I was 18 and 20 and 22 and stuff. That's like, oh no, it's not right yet. Well, you know what? You don't get anywhere. And there came a point in my life when things happened. You know, my father passed on, whatever. And I actually put down the guitar for a couple of years. And then I came back and realized that, you know what, a lot of that stuff is crap. You know, I don't need to play as good as Paul Gilbert or Yngwie. I don't need to be perfect. Like, all I need to do is say what's coming out of my heart and soul, really. Like, you know, basically, I saw Santana on a special one night, and he was actually the guy that got me into guitar in the first place, him and Randy Rhoads. But, you know, he was doing some Letterman, I don't know what it was, 10th anniversary or something, in prime time. And he came out there with this crappy 10-watt practice amp, and his Paul Reed Smith, and he just laid down what's basically like a simple pentatonic blues-type solo. And I sat there, and I was practically freaking crying. I'm like, okay, this is it. I've got to refigure this whole thing. I'm going back. I'm playing again. And, you know, screw it. I don't need to be neoclassical. I don't need to be perfect. Just go for it. And I'll tell you, it gets responses from people. You know, I played out a couple times with different bands, and people will not respond. This happened a couple times. The main guitarist in the band, they're just like, yeah, okay, whatever. People are running up to me and talking to me. So it's like people respond to that. You don't have to worry about being perfect. It's getting out the essence of you and what your heart and your soul want to say. And the rest of it, fuck it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with the solos on the newest album, well, especially the one in Cumulus Crown, like I – you know, nobody's going to know what my original intent was except for me, so
yeah.
I got to let it go. Like, you know, if I'm not happy with it, nobody who listens to it knows what my original intent was and whether or not I set standard, so, you know.
And again, we're coming back to jazz, because, I mean, Brian, you probably saw, I posted the other day a Miles Davis quote, which is, there's no such thing as mistakes. You know, you've thrown out, it's a note to you. Nobody in the audience knows that. They don't care. They just keep going. You know, they think it's that, wow, that was really ingenious. Where did you come with that? You know, why did the key change there? That's interesting. It was a mistake.
I mean, yeah, and you'd think I'd know better, too, especially being a fan of jazz. But it's like, I don't know. I guess I just have a complete OCD complex anyway. I really.
Well, I've been there. That's why I'm saying. That's why I'm sharing this. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Sona Morthy. Coming up, we'll talk.
smoking more stuff.
You're on Third Eye Cinema.
This is Mirai from Psy, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is Dr. McCannibal from Psy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Adam from Tribulation, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is God Minister. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
To put some echo on that.
And in our next segment, we talk influences, the artwork, fun with the photo shoot, and more, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, here's a pair of instrumentals. First off the debut, we go Wandering the Lowlands. Then we move to Revival for A Message from Absalom.
Thank you.
You know, you've told us a little bit, but tell us the story about how this whole thing came about, because I understand that this was initially supposed to be just an instrumental project.
It's funny because on the first album, I did intend for us to do a lot more things that were like 30 seconds long, a minute long, like instrumental passages that would lead from one thing to another, like a typical soundtrack or a score. I was considering more of a score than a soundtrack in my head. Things being what they are, they just sort of mutate. So, like Marcus explained earlier about writing the lyrics for the song that wasn't supposed to have lyrics, and things like that would happen, and it was good, so you don't want to not do it, just to stick to some rigid vision of what you were trying to do. On the EP, we threw a couple instrumentals on there.
Scattered all over them, both albums.
Yeah. We're actually working on a couple of different things for Son of Morty right now that I think we'll wind up with actually having more instrumental stuff on it. But yeah, who knows, by the time I get to the end, who knows how it's going to work out.
Written Blood Red, and even, I think, what was the other one? By Hook and by Crook.
Right.
Wasn't supposed to be that much vocals on it. I ended up having vocals over the whole thing because I just couldn't stop myself.
The little thing, I can't believe, I don't even remember the names of the songs that I played on. Like the whistle song from the first. That's just a little interstitial piece that just ties one thing to the next. We're working on basically a season two kind of deal for the revival. That's going to have a lot more instrumental stuff in it. And then we're working on another thing that's sort of a... The idea partly with the first album was that it was sort of a soundtrack for a movie that didn't exist. We're working on something along the same lines that's going to be another full length. That's basically another movie that doesn't exist. It's got a storyline that runs through it. That will probably have some more instrumental stuff, like just little odds and ends in between things.
And it's still going to be under the Son of Morty name. You're not talking about another side project.
Yeah, it'll be Son of Morty. Right.
Yeah. Frank, I understand you were actually in a different state at the time, and you had just moved out to Ohio to join Brian Marcus Nash in the Vladimir's and Son of Morty.
Well, actually, I used to live in Cincinnati anyway. So, when the Vladimir's first got started, I was friends with them all. And Brian and I lived together in various houses with other roommates and stuff. And then I had moved out to Chicago for work. So, I was out there while they were still doing Vladimir stuff and whatnot. And when we first kicked off the Son of Morty thing, I was still in Chicago. And then 2007, 2008, recession stuff started hitting. And so I wound up moving back to Cincinnati because Cincinnati is just a much more forgiving town money-wise than Chicago is. So my auto insurance in Chicago was like four times what it is here. Like that. It's just, so I moved back to Cincinnati, and the old bass player, Doug, had split maybe the year before, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they were still continuing on wanting to do things, and they asked me if I wanted to play with Vladimir's too, and I'm like, okay, sure. You're friends with everybody anyway. It's just like, yeah, okay, of course I will.
Right.
Frank worked on other projects with us anyways, projects that aren't released per se, but, I mean, Frank and I have been playing music together for I don't even know how long. We've been friends for, what, 30 years? It's not like he came into the fold out of nowhere.
Did you guys meet in kindergarten, right?
Seven, I think, when we met.
Seven. Oh, that's, first grade?
Well, I'm 41, so, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, and with the Vladimir's anyway, I mean, I've done album artwork for him before, and...
He did all of our album artwork.
Right. Before they actually recorded the Odds album, I did demos. I recorded the demos for him. I was first getting into recording, so they're...
All the odd inlay and all that, that's in your house.
Mm-hmm. Type, and that's my handwriting.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of this, what I'm about to say, is relevant, but they could call me and Tim, Tim Seeley.
Yeah.
The guy that does his half of Revival, Frank called me from Chicago and said, hey, Tim and I were talking, we got this idea for this soundtrack to a movie that may or may not exist, and so he came down for a weekend, and he threw out these ideas that him and I had worked on for just random songs back in like 94.
Wow.
And was it Eye for an Eye?
That was one.
And
yeah.
He said, remember this riff? And he threw it out, and I was like, man, yeah, I remember that. I was like, we worked on that for just me and you back in like 94. And
that started out life. It was going to be an industrial song back in 94.
Yeah. we might have actually recorded a thing to a drum machine.
Yeah, see, I kept all my 4-track stuff. I still got like tapes and tapes and tapes of 4-track odds and ends. I bought a 4-track back in like 91 or 92, I think. And back then, it was like, you're young and you spend tons and tons of time just sitting there laying down odds and ends for no good reason. Save it for later, it'll come,
I've been there.
And it actually worked out because I still tapped some of that stuff every now and then. It was stuff I couldn't figure out what to do with at the time.
Right.
Like, I got this cool riff, but I don't know where to take it. So you save it, and then 10 years later, you tap it again, and all of a sudden, you got something else to do with it.
Exactly right. The first album's got some great covers on it. I mean, the front is very dark and expressionist, and I really like the back cover photo with Marcus in the duster and you in the leather cowboy hat and the tracks. So where did you find that particular location? Because that building next to you looks like an old deserted ghost town hotel or something. And it's a very evocative photo, and again, it's tapping into both the spaghetti western vibe and the feeling of utter desolation you seem to be reaching for.
I think that was all your sister. Right?
That's what's so awesome is that it's such utter desolation in where we live. That's like right around a couple miles away from here. You can find stuff like that everywhere around here. It's just, dead industry, buildings that no one uses anymore.
Old neighborhoods.
Old neighborhoods. There's a couple neighborhoods here you could walk through that just the whole neighborhood looks haunted, like Derry and It.
Well, I mean, so, I had said, you know, I know where this railroad crossing is. It's right down the street from my brother's house, and it's, you know, it's not really far removed. It looks like it's in the middle of, like, Dust Bowl desolation or something, but it's, you know, it's, like, right in the middle of the suburban area. But anytime there's, like, a picture location or a video location, it's always me who, I'm always picking it. And everybody's going, like, Marcus is standing on the railroad track, and we're all standing there taking a picture, and there's, like, cars going by. Like, a woman stopped on the railroad track.
She's like, looking good.
Yeah. Pulled down her window and said, looking good. And, like, and we're, you know, we're trying to be, like, discreet about us. Like,
yeah, we were very discreet.
Yeah, we're trying to be cool and tough and goth or whatever, you know.
Tough and goth.
And not really. Not really. We're not taking ourselves that seriously. But it's like, you know, like, I always feel like an idiot because I'm like, come on, it's going to take us 15 minutes. Let's just go down this railroad track, stand on it, and get our picture taken. Marcus is always like, I don't know about that. I got to take a picture out in public, you know.
It's never been, that's why. But the front cover is all crisp. That's
yeah.
All crisp.
Yeah.
And that's actually not, it's not right.
It is.
Initially, I had planned on initially, the whole image was supposed to stretch across a single fold. You could only see up to the tree and the noose, I guess, in the middle, and then the back would be the rest of the stuff. There wasn't that much black underneath, but when we went to go ahead and do the CD, we were putting it out ourselves, and we were like, yeah, maybe we don't actually want to pay for a full-on booklet. I basically had to squish it all up into a square. There's all that black underneath. I'm like, I know white space is good. I like white space. It's fine, but this just doesn't look right. So I'm like, I'll put these skeletons from Totentons in there. I was trying to see, this is my fault. I was trying to get tricky and do a printing trick. Like Brian said, we all used to work at a printing place, you know, little things like that. And I was trying to print the skeletons in just the single black, the K-channel, while the rest of the black would be a build of CMYK. What it was supposed to do is be really subtle. So that, like, you'd have to tilt it into the light or something. Sort of like the front of the Metallica's Black Album with the little snake on the corner.
Oh.
And it was supposed to be really subtle like that, but it turned out that when they printed the black really light because the build was too heavy.
Well, they were sitting there printing going, don't you want to see those skeletons?
What's wrong with... I'm like, no, I just want to be really subtle, and they didn't get that. Because the proof they gave me looked right. But then when we got the CDs, I'm going like, oh, this isn't right at all.
So there's actually skeletons there that we can't see.
I don't know. I didn't see them too much.
Yeah, you know, the skeletons came out a little grayer than they were supposed to.
Tell us the story on this album, because I know it's got something to do with ghosts, but that's about it.
Well,
but there was an original narrative, and then we just went the David Lynch route, so it turned into, I don't know, almost insanity.
The loose story was... I've got it written down at home, and it doesn't make as much sense when I say it out loud. Essentially, it was sort of a take on. You ever see Neverwhere, the Neil Gaiman?
Oh, I love that one, yeah.
I sort of tied it in my head to being the TV show Neverwhere.
Yeah, and that's actually what I was thinking of, the one with Tamsin Grieg from Black Books.
Uh-huh, and it was the idea was that there was a sort of a Chicago underneath Chicago, an alternate world, like where people go to, and it's sort of a, it's not quite limbo, because you interact with stuff, and you interact with bits of the city, but it's not all there. So something tragic happens to this lady, her boyfriend wants to getting killed, and she's, you know, injured and near death, and she wakes up and she's in this under Chicago thing. It turns out that her boyfriend was killed by a sort of a gang boss.
Spoiler alert.
For the movie that'll never get made. So she wakes up and she finds out this stuff, and she kind of goes on a rampage to revenge her boyfriend's death.
Okay.
Well, it's a revenge.
Okay.
But... Yeah, but so she goes on this sort of rampage and tracks down the mob boss guy, and it turns in this big culmination where she realizes that something happens, and then blah, 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 blah. But that was sort of the story.
Right. I was really wondering about some tracks like Two Southern Hearts, particularly as so far as I know, none of you guys are Southerners.
Marcus technically qualifies as a Southerner because he's from Kentucky originally.
Originally. Oh. I mean, I lived in Kentucky until I was 11, and then I moved up to Ohio. But, I mean, it was still the Cincinnati area. It was Covington, which is... But my family, I mean, I spent summers down in South Kentucky with family members, and you meet quite the colorful cast of characters down there.
Yeah, a lot of my family.
Someone that's kind of influenced me in some ways. That song's kind of a weird song anyways. It's not necessarily talking about, you know, the South of America. It's talking about the South of your soul and your heart kind of deal, where it's just sunken and desperate.
I guess that explains the slight accent that I hear with you. I thought that was just like an Ohio accent or something. But
oh, it's the greater Cincinnati area. But me, the more I drink, the more they get more animated and ridiculous. So I'm kind of a king character, so I kind of make it worse on purpose.
Well, what's sad is I actually had a friend from North Carolina, and he thought I was a Southerner just because of the way I say some words, but I picked that up from my father, and that's just because he used to be married to a Southern woman from Georgia, and that was before I was born. So he carried that with him. I picked it up from him, and it's still bleeding through, even though I've got a New York accent otherwise.
Yeah, that'll happen.
I think it's all relative, too. I remember when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, me and my friends would just jump in a van and go to Chicago for the weekend, hang out or whatever. And when I first started going out there, I specifically remember going to a show and talking to somebody that had a really thick Chicago accent. Could barely understand her. She's telling me to go to this place after the show and we could all hang out. I'm like, you're going to have to go slow. I'm from Ohio. I don't really understand what you're saying. She thought I was from Deep South. Something like that, you know?
The album actually crosses a number of genres, like I was mentioning before, and I think the old school gothic rock side really comes out on Black Robe Witness. You got those relentless drums that evoke Kevin Hastings with Bauhaus, or some of the bands I mentioned earlier, like Southern Death Cult, Ghost Dance, Skeletal Family, that sort of thing. Were you striving for a ritualistic vibe here, or was that entirely accidental?
I wouldn't say it was accidental, but I think that's the way the song, we wrote it, and that's how we wanted that out. We pretty much clicked on it right off the bat.
I mean, I'm not a drummer by, a good drummer, is what I want to say. I'm not a drummer by having played drums for a long time. I'm a drummer by, I just sort of like doing it, and it was a necessity. And when I play drums, I tend to not play like a jazz person would play, or an actually technically proficient person would play. So you kind of fall into those rhythms, those heavy tom things with tribal overtones, I guess.
And the Ants, who's the one that spun off from them, the original Ants, with Annabella Lee? They did I Want Candy, Bow Wow Wow, you know, that kind of Burundi drumming vibe.
That's one of those things, I think it's almost instinctive to play like
I remember there was a patient that Brian and I had years ago was with a lot of that type of music. If we were going to try to do that type of music, was that the old late 70s, early 80s kind of goth rock, is that none of the drummers hardly ever used cymbals. It
True.
Was like sparse. It was all tribal type drumming.
Well, you hear that a big time in Southern Death Cult. Like,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah. I don't think he's ever hit cymbals hardly at all on that, right?
It's a lot of tom work. Sounds like some sort of like tribal cave music or something.
Yeah, and like early Swans. Well, I mean, early Swans, they do use cymbals, but I mean, there's a lot of this heavy beating the crap out of the snare and the tom and the bass drum.
Yeah,
right.
So it's like a natural thing. We didn't ever discuss it, really. You know, like, how should that sound? We've all known each other long enough and know the songs, like the things that we like. It's always, that's what's so cool and easy about it, is we're like, oh, I know what that is. I can do that. And
right.
We don't even us word at how those drums are supposed to be. They were just perfect things.
I think it might be fitting to say that none of us knew what any of these songs were going to sound like until we didn't practice these songs. Like, none of us practiced these songs at all. What it was I recorded my guitar part, and then afterwards, Chris threw a drum beat to it, and then, you know, in his bass, and then Marcus put vocals to it, and then, like, I didn't know what the final thing was even going to, none of us knew what the final tracks were going to sound like until Crank mashed them all together.
It's like you said, it was like studio work. It was like the first time we were just like,
session.
The first time you're going to hear it is the day we're going to record it.
Before I go on, let me mention once again that, Marcus, you're honestly one of my favorite vocalists out there today, especially in the punk alternative realm. I mean, you got such a strong baritone and just enough of that Elvis Danzig style Southern twang to bring out the whole rockabilly thing I grew up on and love. And I think that's a major part of what makes both the Vladimirs and Sonomorty work so well. It's powerful and haunting at the same time. You wouldn't get the same effect with a reedy kind of tenor fronting the stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Eye for an Eye feels very Samhain, or people always say Samhain, like something off of November Coming Fire or Final Descent, maybe To Walk the Night.
Yeah, and also a little bit of maybe Fields of the Nephilim thrown in there.
And both Vasty Deep and Dagos Black really sound akin to something like, again, Southern Death Cult or Virgin Prunes with that trumpet backing.
Oh, my brother,
That's Brian's brother did that, yeah.
My brother played trumpet on that. I always try to, with these projects like this, especially Sono Morte, I like to be able to incorporate as many people and as many instruments. I mean, we're all, Chris and I are sort of like gadget, Chris to the 10th power is like a gadget junkie, you know? He's like, he's pointing to my like incessant guitar collection over there. I've got like 16 guitars up here. But Chris, he's like a insane
gadget guru.
Gadget junkie. guru junkie. So we like to incorporate as many weird, especially weird instruments, anything that'll do the job to get the sound that we want, be it a Coke bottle with a firecracker inside or whatever, just anything,
you know. Brian, Terra Incognita, which is one of your vocal turns, reminds me a bit of REM by way of Exuma, if anybody remembers him. I mean, there's some really bizarre voodoo-oriented folk music from the early 70s, and it's definitely the most haunting of your vocal tracks, particularly with Marcus sort of chanting behind you.
Yeah, that's almost all Brian and me doing a little bit of background, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that song, see, that was another one where we demoed this entire album, well, most of this album before we actually recorded the final cut, and that was one of those songs where I was much happier with the demo version, because I did it here by myself. I did it all, and then I couldn't recapture the same nuances, but yeah,
I like that song. It's a good song.
I like it too. Yeah. It was sort of, I don't know, like, I'm trying to think if I drew it from any particular influences from that. I really don't think I did. It was just sort of like an odd shot, you know?
Every time you step to the mic, the band takes more of a turn towards classic rock. I mean, something about your tonality, or do you naturally lean in that direction?
I mean,
I'd say you lean towards it.
I'd say you would lean towards the 70s.
More of a 70s.
Like a classic rock sound.
Well, I just can't do baritone at all. Like, when I do baritone, ridiculous.
Well, not really, though. I mean, look at this. I mean, you do low vocals on stuff.
The lowest I got ever, well, I don't know. I did the vocals on the instrumental, Chanty, Wandering the Lowlands. I did all the vocals on that.
Yeah.
I think I got some lower range stuff on that.
Right.
I guess what I mean is, I have to, if I'm doing low vocals, it has to be my low vocals. I can't pull off a Marcus baritone on the second release. At the end?
Yeah.
With that one, I got a little bit of a lower range in there, but I mean, honestly, especially at the end, I actually was not trying to do the rock thing. I was trying to do the goth thing. So I don't know if that came through or not. My trying to do the goth thing may have only worked its way into some sort of 70s hard rock sound, but that was me attempting to do goth.
Okay, that's what I was saying. It wasn't necessarily just the fact that, okay, you've got a higher voice. That doesn't mean anything. It just sounds like the music shifts away from more of that gothy, punky sort of sound to being more of that classic rock thing.
I agree with you. I think that's actually just the way Brian writes songs. I mean, I think your songs are like, your style is more, you're more inclined to that type of style.
Because I didn't write the music for At the End, and Chris did. I wrote the vocals and the lyrics, but I mean, you know, I had to write it based on whatever he wrote. But yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, obviously, I guess naturally I'm going to write what I can sing to, so.
Yeah, it feels like a late 70s, early 80s type of song.
Well, and for instance, like, with At the End, that and I think the other song off the EP that Marcus sung, not the Western one.
Undying Mystery.
Yeah.
Or
Undying Mystery. Yeah, both of those, I had written on one of those little portable living room organs that were big in the 60s and 70s. I had written both of those based around like some organ stuff I was doing on that. And when I was on that, I was thinking about a band from Canada called Le Breastfeeders. They're kind of a weird French garage rock, really raw sounding, this heavy organ, jangly guitars and things. So I'm thinking about that, but they're sort of a throwback to 60s stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it like a Stereo Lab kind of thing where they got all those vintage, because I actually have one of those organs you're talking about from the old house. I kept it. It's one of the few things I brought over with me.
It's like they're major pieces of furniture.
Exactly. Right.
In my head, it's not like necessarily I'm trying to write a 60 song or a 70 song or anything, but I guess those are the things that run through my head when I'm putting them together. So yeah, a lot of that vibe probably comes through that way.
Speaking of songs you sang, Crimson Rider evokes Wall of Voodoo very strongly during the verses, and then it veers right into 70s rock with the chorus. And I like your psychedelic style solo there.
Yeah, you know, I can give you and your listeners a little insight, like, no? No. Okay. No. I mean, I definitely, yeah, you're right. No, I
what
really...
What are you guys talking about?
Nothing.
All right.
Clue us in. What's going on?
No, I mean, I definitely drew heavily on some 70s influences for that song. I'm going to try to skirt this issue as much as I can now. But I... Because Marcus, it seems... He actually sat up.
I'm curious. He got me curious. I'm like, what are you guys talking about?
I actually tried to contact two 70s sort of iconic rock people to participate in these things. And I didn't get a response from either one of them, but I definitely was heavily influenced on that song by two particular 70s rock icons, I guess you'd say. The solo, that was just all me, but I mean, the other stuff may have been...
As I recall, that solo had a very... Page influence to it.
You kept saying Ritchie Blackmore, but
That too, yeah.
Which, I mean, that's those were two of my, I'm looking at a picture of Ritchie Blackmore on my wall right now. But yeah, I mean, Paige Blackmore, that's just where I come from as far as, I listen to stuff, a lot of 70s prog rock that nobody's ever heard of. And
Gentle Giant? Zappa?
I like Gentle Giant, but their vocalist was sort of off-putting to me. But like, I mean, Culpepper's Orchard or Samurai or, I mean, I have like.
Cherry Red.
Camel.
Love Camel. Yeah, I love Camel.
Captain Beyond. Now I'm just throwing band names out there that I like.
Absolutely, Captain Beyond.
Arthur Brown's Kingdom Come.
Hey, yeah.
Caravan.
Great Arthur Brown, yeah. Yeah, pretty much almost if you name it. That's such a broad category that I'm sure you could come up with bands I've never heard, but sorry, I've gone way off the topic for the question.
Well, anyway. Listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Sona Morty. In our next segment, we see how close Ohio is to Canada as we talk to Gordon Lightfoot, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
For a blue girl, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody. Shall I start again? Okay. Hi, everybody. Alex from Atrocity. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy the day.
Hey, this is Davey Vane from Vane. I want you to get very close to your speakers right now, right up against your speakers, because you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
And in our next segment, we talk Gordon Lightfoot, the horrors of the Midwest, and the sorry state of modern comics. But before that, here's another one off the debut, which we just discussed. This is Crimson Rider.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, just moving on through the tracks. Wandering the Lowlands is interesting as hell to me. It reminded me of the sort of acoustic interplay that Pentangle had, you know, with Burt Jansch and John Renborn playing off each other. And then you go into that Native American-style chanting and the village bell ringing. You know, that just says spaghetti western right away. Really like that track. It's one of the strongest ones on the album, and it's just instrumental.
Let me tell you something that's amazing about that track to me was I wrote the music for that track, and I and Chris and myself like watch a lot of spaghetti westerns, but
yeah,
Brian
too.
Necessarily doesn't. He's probably seen the couple that I've shoved in his face over the years, and he did that vocal melody, which was perfect. And I was just I couldn't believe it when he did it. I was like, you sound like you know exactly what was supposed to happen there, and he did it perfect. And it was totally like not even planned or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did the background music, and then he came up with them vocals, and I was blown away. I was like, man, you sound like you've studied this type of stuff, and he's just just the one that I've shoved in his face over the years. He seemed to got, he had the knack for it perfectly.
I remember distinctly, I went over to Marcus's apartment, and I recorded, I said, hey, show me what it is, your idea that you got or whatever, and I think I took my digital recorder over, and I recorded him doing the acoustic guitar, and so I brought it back here. So basically, the only thing Marcus knew that he knew about the song was the riff that he did, and then I put the vocal thing down to it, and I gave the thing that Marcus did and my vocal thing to Chris, and then he put his thing on it, and so by the time it got back to Marcus, it was a whole different animal. And once I heard it, I didn't know what Crank was going to do to it either, but that's basically how all these songs work. It's like a snowball effect. Like one person gives somebody something, somebody else adds to it, and then by the time you hear it, it's like a completely different thing. And I very rarely say this, but I was proud of the way it turned out. If Marcus would have said he didn't like what I did to that song, I would have been heartbroken because I thought it turned out really well.
I very rarely say this also about being proud about a song. I was blown away. I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
That song to me sounded like something out of those films.
Yeah.
And I didn't even expect it to.
And even on top of that, just the guitar interplay. I mean, that's why I thought you were referencing Pentangle, which, you know, you never hear that. Because you guys are really playing off each other on the guitars.
Well, actually, that's just Marcus.
Yeah, all the guitars, that's me, yeah.
Some of these songs is just one, like it's not necessarily everybody playing, well, all three of us play guitar, but that song is just Marcus, so.
How many times did you have to track yourself for that?
Maybe two or three. There's a rhythm, and I did a lead. I had to dump the rhythm in a couple other little spots there.
Okay, because I was like, wow, you guys are really playing off each other's clothes, and you really have everything down.
I guess it's kind of deceiving because Marcus is actually just complimenting himself, which is probably easy to do.
Right. Well, I don't know how easy it is, but yeah.
Easy for me to compliment myself.
You're okay, Marcus.
So I think the only track that stands out a bit in terms of, like, why is this track here, is The Want, which feels so 70s rock. I mean, it doesn't have the same eerie, desolate atmosphere that the rest of the record has. So was that intended to be on the record originally, or did you just pull another song that you've written that you thought, it might fit here? Because it works well as a song, but in terms of Sono Morti, it stands out like a sore thumb.
I always thought it kind of sounded like Gordon Lightfoot to me. Which fell in line with the kind of 70s vibe we were looking at anyway.
Right.
That was a Brian song.
Yeah, I would figure that. Very 70s, like I said.
I'd be lying if I didn't say that it wasn't influenced by Gordon Lightfoot, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Like, the chord progressions are very similar.
That swing, right. Too.
Yeah, and that sort of, like you said, the swing, like the tempo or whatever. But, I mean, it's obviously not a Dead ripoff, but I sort of wanted to juxtapose that song with the rest of the album because that song actually is, like, major chord progressions. So I just wanted there to be this sort of, like, well, you know how the Misfits would do, like, a major chord thing with, like, a sad lyrical content.
The Misfits in particular, you're right. That was a constant because he was always doing that kind of 50s rock, like, oh, this is nice and happy. He's talking about like killing your mother or something.
I thought that was, I purposely, like you said, stick out like a sore thumb. That was definitely intentional on my part that song should stick out like a sore thumb, you know.
Again, when you're looking at this in terms of being sort of a soundtrack or a score, it's sort of meant to be whatever fits whatever that scene is supposed to be.
It's funny that you reference Gordon Lightfoot because, you know, nowadays the only time I think of him comes from that scene in Canadian Bacon when she gets the flowers get well soon from Gordon Lightfoot.
Were we talking about when we were recording the album? Were we talking about doing a cover of Sundown?
Yeah, we were. We were going to do a 7-inch and then doing a B-side of a cover of Sundown by Gordon Lightfoot, which I stand with that because I think Marcus would do a great job of singing that song.
I really like that song, and If You Could Read My Mind, I think that's a great song too.
No, but Sundown would have fit the vibe totally. That would have been right in line. That wouldn't have stood out, especially with the dark.
But I guess just like my final thought on The Want. You know, every movie, even if it's, well, I can't say every movie. I'm envisioning envisioning like my limited exposure to these kind of spaghetti westerns. That song, I think, was the hopeful part of the movie,
right,
or where there was a glimmer of hope, maybe.
Right,
you know?
The romance scene or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Brian was real reluctant, I remember. Remember, you came and you like showed me the song, and you're like, I don't think we should, typical way we do things is that we always immediately shoot our own ideas down. So Brian walked, here's a song I got, and I don't even think we should use it. And he played it for me, and I was like, I think we should use it. And he's like, why? And I was like, because I like the song. And he's like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah. I was like, all right.
So let's move on and talk Revival. Now, first of all, you're tapping into an indie comic series here. So is this still ongoing or has it been collected into a trade yet?
The first trade just came out, I think, last month.
I'll have to check that out.
I think it's the first six issues, if I'm remembering right.
It's really good. It picks up quite a lot of readers also.
Yeah, it's doing really well for, you know, being a... It's out from Image Comics.
Who's the comic company?
Image.
Oh, yeah, so you'll get readers for sure. I won't ask what inspired the whole farm noir milieu, because I know you guys hail from the heartland, so it's all sort of farm territory and wide open spaces, desolate expanse, especially from the way you were describing it, at least from the way we view it on the coast. But it's sort of unusual, because you have a few old 70s films that tap into it, like Crowhaven Farm, The Other, maybe The Devonsville Terror, but it's not something people really talk about or focus on, unless you're talking about the early seasons of Smallville or something.
Well, Tim, the writer, he actually grew up in Wisconsin. Actually, I think he grew up in the town that the comic takes place in. You know, it's weird up there growing up. It's one of those things where you're by big cities, but you're pretty much cut off. You're very much in a small town, and a lot of strange things happen up there, and they wanted something that had the vibe of sort of a Twin Peaks-ish kind of modern, but it's still kind of, in ways, it's very backwards. Or very, not retro, but not antique. That's the word I'm looking
for. I mean, I don't necessarily think that horror and film noir are that much different as far as when you're dealing with like a deeper matter of mystique and dread.
Right.
And I love film noir. There's tons of movies like that. Even all the modern stuff from Bogart to Lynch. I love that. And we talked about that when we were fishing, when we were doing Revival, was that there was a little bit of a Twin Peaks thing going on there.
Yeah, and like I said, it's kind of unusual because you don't hear people talking about this kind of creepiness of the heartland once you get out of the 70s, except for maybe the first couple seasons of Smallville tapped into that a little bit. But normally speaking, it's just kind of forgotten. And yet you've got this whole area, you know, the middle of the country, and you guys have postal codes that are like 42 degrees longitude, you know, 50 west. I'm like, what the hell? So it is, this kind of thing does exist, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, and you figure, well, up in places like Wisconsin, I mean, when it's not that it's winter all the time up there, but when it gets to be winter, you know, it's not like in southern Ohio here, we get stuff that's, you know, we're still pretty far north latitude-wise.
Yeah.
But, you know, our winters, they're cold and they get stuff, you know, we get some snow here and there. It's not that bad. And
right.
Even when I'm in Chicago, which is a little further north and off a lake at that, you know, it's cold, it gets really cold, like burn your nose hairs cold, but it's still not that bad, you know.
Only occasionally.
Up in Wisconsin, when it's winter, it's winter.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
it's cold,
months.
It's snowy, it's you're locked in, you've got to stack up on supplies, you know, stuff like that. I think that's sort of a built-in sense of, it's like, you know, much like a thing, you know, it's that built-in sense of isolation, even though you're not more than, you know, 50 feet away from another person if you're living in your house, you know. Tap into that vibe, that sort of localized
isolation. Yeah,
it's
right.
Funny you did the whole middle America crossing with noir. I think that's a genre that's going to explode here in a couple years, because it's one of those old genres that hasn't been tapped into extremely yet.
Even recently, they sort of tap into things like American Gothic.
Yeah,
was sort of like that.
You know, I would even say, well, this is an American movie, but I had just over a couple weeks ago watched an Australian film called The Loved Ones, and that had that had a very, even though it was Australia, it had that kind of like John Hughes meets like the worst possible thing ever.
Yeah.
So it had a middle America feeling that was Australian. But it had like, you know, horrible, horrible elements of that movie.
Even though it wasn't strictly a horror movie, Winter's Bone was still very much in that vein.
Winter's Bone, yeah.
I mean, that was very like, you know, it's sort of a Midwest secluded small town kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where bad things happen.
Yeah,
right.
Like Blue Velvet.
Now, the few sample pages that I had seen in the comic so far remind me of something that Crushton would have put out a few years back, like Meridian or something, but with more of that sort of Midnight Mass style darkness. So, Frank, you've been working on this project. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I lettered the book. My friend Tim writes it, and my other friend Mike draws it. I'm not really sure. I mean, they're definitely going for a lot of mood, a lot of atmosphere. They hint at things. They're going for a long game on this. Each issue is, things happen. There's events and things that move forward, but it's really about the season, I guess. Sort of like a modern television. Or
larger story that's constantly unfolding.
That's kind of the vibe they've been going for lately anyway. I mean, we quit comics a few years back. Remember that whole Civil War thing that was pushing this like Bush-style Patriot Act fascism, and DC started reinventing itself the other week with all these damn 52 crossovers. But, you know, at the time even, they were still going towards, you didn't get a self-contained story like, you know, back in the 70s. It was every issue. That was it. That was the story. And maybe it was a two-parter, but that was the end of it. Whereas now they're like, oh, here's like 6 issues, here's 12 issues, here's like a year's worth of stuff, and it's all kind of broken out, and you just kind of keep going. It's almost like a soap opera. Like, okay, what's going to happen? 12 issues later, you find out.
Well, that's the big two companies, though. What? You know, I mean, Marvel and DC never met a tree they didn't like. They've taken books, and when you get them big storylines like Civil War, you know, if you want to follow all of it, you end up buying, I don't even know, 20 books a month, which is ridiculous.
Right.
Because I get caught up in that. I remember when Secret Invasion was going on, at one point I actually bought a Ms. Marvel book, and I was sitting in the car going, what the hell did I buy a Ms. Marvel book for?
Actually, that new Captain Marvel, which is Ms. Marvel?
Yeah.
That new Captain Marvel book is really good.
I'm sure there's some decent moments, but I never thought of it. He wrote buying Ms. Marvel because I was following all that crossover crap, but I understand why they do it.
Well, even
the yeah, make money. What the hell?
Yeah. I mean, as long as people are buying them, they're going to keep doing it.
And they do tell decent stories occasionally. You'll find I picked up like a Young Avengers, which I never would have done, and it was decent, but I didn't keep with it. So.
Yeah, I mean, crossovers aside, I mean, the whole idea of decompressed storytelling has been going on since the late 90s anyway.
Yeah,
exactly. Right.
You spend this and you got stuff like, you know, that. Basically, a book full of talking heads.
Don't mention Vantage to me. Good Lord.
he's a good idea, man.
That kind of stuff became normal, though.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be, should it? Vantage shouldn't be something that goes on all year.
And the crossovers, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not real thrilled with the current state of crossovers in comics. Because, you know, I read, like, Wolverine and the X-Men, which is started out to be a pretty decent book. But
right.
It crosses the whole the Phoenix thing that was going on.
Oh, that's never-ending. That thing never stops. The Phoenix crap.
Yeah, but it was the whole thing where the Phoenix, you know, got multiple X-Men. So
yeah.
But that's been going on since the 70s, for God's sakes.
Sorry, what'd you say?
It's been going on since the 70s. I mean, every time you think they got rid of her, she comes back again. Or, look, it's Rachel. Oh, wait, no, it's Hope. It's like, God knows.
Whenever they're hard up for like the MacGuffin in the storyline, it's always like, oh, it was a Phoenix all along.
But honestly, I mean, the current DC aren't much better. The two Jeff Lemire stuff that were like Swamp Thing and Animal Man and things like that were pretty good books. And then they started doing all this crossover with the Rotworld thing, and it's just not that great.
Yeah.
You know? And like, because you're not getting all the stories. It's like,
you don't have all the money to
buy all this crap.
Yeah, you got to buy all of it to understand what the hell is going on, and that's ridiculous.
And I don't care to buy it all.
And when they're going to complain about, like, why aren't kids buying the stuff, it's like, when we were kids, I could buy a comic for 5 to 50 cents,
right.
And now they're $4.
Well, when I was a kid, though, I loved the crossovers because they didn't happen that much.
No, they happened once a year, maybe they'd skip a year sometimes.
You'd have some, like,
right.
Or the Inferno thing, late 80s, Inferno storyline.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while, like, Spider-Man would show up in X-Men, and that was cool.
But I can't imagine walking up to, if I was a kid now, and I'd be like, hey, Mom and Dad, I want to go to the comic book store.
It's going
to
be at least $60.
It's going to be at least $60 to me, get a couple books. Ridiculous.
I remember my father giving me like $2 or $3 and complaining about it, and I still walked out with a big, huge pile of stuff. And now, forget it. What are you going to get? One comic?
As earlier, I got this calendar for Star Wars. My calendar hanging up in my kitchen is old Star Wars comics, and they still have the prices on them. They're 35 cents.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
and I'm like,
exactly.
It's 1978 on it. It's 35 cents. And here we are now, 2013. Says $4.99.
When I first started buying, like as a kid, when I first started buying my own comics, they were still 50 and 60 cents. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
And
you
know, still 20
the big
pages.
Excuse is, oh, we need better paper. I mean, who cares? You know, just put it back in the newsprint.
I mean, part of inflation, too. I mean, everybody's got to live.
Inflation,
you know?
Though.
The people that draw it got to make a living.
You're
the
right.
That write it got to make a living. Because
yeah.
If this is all they do, they got to make a living.
Right, yeah, I know.
Or else they're not going to be able to keep doing it.
Well, of course, right. But still. Anyway, but, you know, Craig, you mentioned last time you spoke, obviously, as we're talking here, you were in comics and you did the covers for a lot of Vladimir's stuff as well as Son of Morty. So I had assumed you were an artist by trade, but do you actually illustrate any series or just are you just doing the lettering?
No, as far as comics go, I'm just a letterer.
You do covers, though, don't you?
I, I did a few covers here and there for a series called Hackflash, but that was more sort of a photo manipulation kind of stuff, not actually illustration.
That's Tim Seeley's thing, right?
Yeah.
Hackflash is Tim.
Well, it's because we all worked together for years at a comic studio.
Well, didn't you do a couple of ads for like other, you did like a, didn't you do like a Nike, no, not Nike, you did some other, he's done other illustration stuff. Like
It's not really illustration so much as it's more, that's what I'm saying, I could never do a monthly like sequential comic because that's just beyond me.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I guess you've done design, I guess what I could just say. Design.
Right, yeah, I mean, I'm more in the design and photo manipulation and things
so like that. So you're more like the Dave McKean or J.H. Williams type.
Along those lines, sure. You know, like I said, it's a thing that, I don't know, it's one of those things where I enjoy doing it, but I don't think I'd enjoy doing it for a living.
Right. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Sona Morty. And coming up next, we talk ghostly doings as we discuss the Haunted EP. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
Singer Beauty O, and you listen to the show Third Eye Cinema.
This is Rick Ross from Massacre, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is James Murphy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Greetings, pathetic mortal scum. This is Chris from Gloriana, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
That's my evil wizard.
Wow, that was great. Can you do one in the pirate voice?
Sure, I could be Captain Chris from Aelstorm if you want that.
Sure.
God, that's all I do is put on fucking accents all day long. Ahoy there, shipmates. This is Chris from Aelstorm, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Yar.
Wow.
I hate myself.
No, that was great. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And in our final segment, we discuss the Haunted EP, John Carpenter films, and some upcoming projects to look forward to. But first, we have one more from the debut. This is Eye for an Eye.
Thank you.
getting back to the EP, what is with that creepy-ass cover? I love it. It's so wrong.
Chris has got a good...
That's Chris.
Craig's
yeah.
got a good story behind this.
I get in and out of, like, obsessive things.
Right.
Like collector kind of things or whatever, you know? And at the time, I started collecting old negatives, like negative the 40s and 50s, not just photos, but the actual negatives, you know what I'm saying? So I came across this negative of this girl, and she just had this, I'm thinking it was a holiday thing or something like that, I'm not really sure, but it just had that creepy grin going on, and looking out from under her brows, and I'm like, you know what, I can use this for something.
I was looking at that, I'm like, God, I hope that's not one of their daughters. It's like so creepy.
Yeah, just the photo itself was creepy enough, and then I worked in the piece with they call him the Creep in the comic. Well, it actually doesn't have a name in the comic yet, but you know, internally we call it the Creep. So I worked him into the photo, and it just turned out I really liked it.
yeah, it's so wrong, but I love it.
I think he's missing I don't know if this came across in his description there, but he actually, didn't you buy that on eBay, that negative?
Yeah, it was a negative. Like I said, I get in the collector modes. Or whatever.
So we have no idea who that person is.
Wow.
Well, you know, when that picture was taken, I'm guessing it was 50s because of the decor.
It might have right. been 40.
And it was like Atomic Age. So yeah. I'm guessing it's like 50s stuff because there's that lamp in the background. It's got that kind of weird Atomic Age kind of thing going on.
That we have someone who is probably incredibly old or dead now and on the front cover don't know who they are. And they may not even know that they're on the front cover.
They don't know.
Well, what's cool about it is it also fits back into that whole haunted Americana type thing. That
right.
looks very old American, and then here's this this creepy guy, creepy thing coming up behind her.
Yeah, so, I mean, and it goes back to the whole thing of found art that used to be so big back in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, that too. It was just one of those things that it kind of came together at the right time. I got the picture just as we were starting to work on that thing.
When we were doing the Undying Mystery song, that's like Chris wrote all the music for that, and I came up with the vocal melody and the lyrics. I was pretty much just staring at that picture. It totally weirded me out in like a cool way. I couldn't quite figure out why it was so weird to me. I mean, I knew elements, but as a whole, I'm like, why is this especially bizarre to me?
It's the paneling in the background.
It might have been the paneling. Paneling bothers me.
Yeah, every time I like to have the cover art in front of me, but every time I play the album, I just sit there and stare at that thing the whole time. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, it adds an extra vibe to the whole.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
So intro, which is what you called it, sounds like a Vladimir's track. You know, it's one of those retro 50s ones, like I Saw You at the Drive-In, for example. You know, there's a lot of that old doo-wop ballad feel to it. So, Craig, that's your wife talking? Does she really have that thick an accent? You know, I like accents. It was just such a thick Midwestern drawl.
I'm actually not married. No, that was actually, should I say it? Yeah, that's okay. That was actually my mother. I needed a fill-in. My original intention for it, because, well, the story is supposed to be up in Wisconsin. I was going to use a Brian's cousin-in-law, I guess. It was Brian's wife's niece. That's what it was.
Cousin-in-law.
I don't know what. What do you call that?
The cousin-in-law. That sounds like a Pauly Shore movie.
It all gets really complicated. But my initial idea was to use Brian's wife's niece because she has a pretty thick, like, Minnesota kind of accent. So I wanted something like that, but when I was putting the piece together, I needed a sort of a stand-in track, I guess. So I wanted somebody that kind of had sort of a woman's range, and I went over and asked my mother and said, okay, can you sing this in? And then I adjusted that a little bit in the computer to be pitched up a little bit, and it came out sounding like the little lady from Poltergeist.
This house is clean.
Zelda. But that's a real accent that wasn't put on?
Oh, no. I mean, that's the actual accent, yeah.
Wow, it fits in so well. I was just like, wow. I'm really wondering, does this person really sound like this, or you just say, okay, this is what I want you to talk like?
She sounds charmingly demented.
She doesn't act down like that, because like I said, I pitched it up probably, you know, a cent and a half or something like that. But,
right.
But yeah, the accent.
So Undying Mystery, which, you know, Marcus just mentioned, it sounds like Sisters of Mercy meets the Zombies with that 60s organ and the multi-track Andrew Eldritch-style vocals. It's actually probably my favorite track on the record.
Thanks. Yeah, like I said, when I was writing that and I was writing the Etienne, and I wrote those, like I said, on a living room organ. So they had that kind of digital, or the transistor organ sound, and that sort of sharp thing, and I guess sort of those patterns, those arrangements, too. And I was also thinking, you know, I mean, I'm a pretty huge fan of Joy Division and Bauhaus and things like that. Going for that sort of, I don't know, that that open vibe that they had.
Yeah, because they used a lot of space. You're right.
Verby, yeah, like real verby, some echoes going on, things like that. I wanted some space involved in there.
That's actually something you guys have that's pretty retro, because especially in Sono Morte, not so much in the Vladimir's, but even there. Because bands nowadays tend to, I don't know if it's the Pro Tools or if it's just everybody's used to hearing it, but it's constant, a barrage of noise no matter what's going on, you know, whether it's this instrument, that instrument, background, whatever. Whereas you get to have, especially in Gothic, but in all the stuff from the 80s, you have a big sense of space and openness. And I remember I had played some of my band's old stuff to a friend of mine, and he was shocked by that. He's like, yeah, you use a lot of negative space. And I had to think about that, because I'm like, it wasn't conscious, but it was something from that time period, that kind of influence that, again, nowadays you don't hear much.
Well, right. I mean, you had to economize your tracks if you only had X amount of them. And it is really easy to fall into a trap of just trying to fill every little area of it. You know, you need white space for stuff.
Right. Exactly. And it makes a difference. There's a dynamic variation. There's an attentive variation. Like, you know, when something's just barraging you constantly, like black metal, you know, you kind of zone out and trance out. That's part of the soporific quality of it, where you kind of go, ooh, and you're off on another planet somewhere. Whereas if you've got something that's got space and dynamics to it, it tends to engage you more. It's more of an active involvement between the listener and the musician.
Yeah, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I like to think of it as more of a everything turning into a buzzing drone versus sort of a melange where you can still pick out.
Exactly, right.
But it's still attractive.
I mean, I like noisy stuff, but I think it has to have a point to it. You can't just be throwing on layers and layers of crap just because,
right.
Oh, layer it up. But if you can get to that meditative space, you can get there with less. It's better.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
And I think, preface to Chris, kudos to him for being able to pull that off, because I can't do that. I mean, I do some of my own recording and engineering and stuff, and that's a hard thing to do. I'm not even sure, like, that's like a talent. I can't seem to accomplish that. I don't know. Like,
what do you mean? Like a meditative state with
work? Big, making something sound big. I don't understand. I can't grasp that concept as far as, I mean, I can grasp the concept of as a listener, but not as an engineer or a producer. It's hard for me to do that. I don't understand. There's a fine balance, I think.
And I mean, that's also, I think when I was talking to my friend there, I had to think about what he was talking about, the negative space. I was like, well, you know, it's probably going way back, you know, before the metal influences, before the punk influences, before the goth influences even, to rockabilly. Because, again, I mean, yeah, a lot of it was fast tempo, whatever, but you've got that heavy reverb. And in a lot of cases, you've got a hell of a lot of space there, especially like the kind of thing like when you were, Danzig taps into that Elvis thing with all the, you know, like American Nightmare, for example. You know, there's a lot of space involved there, even though it's a short song and it's compact and it's chugging all the way through. Again, that's something that makes it sound a lot bigger than something like Borzum.
It's funny that we had a conversation about rockabilly last night. You both had something to say, so go ahead.
I was just going to say that, yeah, rockabilly and you know, early Sandman stuff and that, a lot of what they shared in common was the fact that they were really only tracking the people that were actually playing then. You know what I'm saying? Like, one guitar, you had a bass, you had drums, so you would just track that stuff and fill it out with things like reverb or facial stuff like, roto chorus kind of things and stuff like that to kind of fill the space out rather than just filling it with another instrument or more noise or whatever. They used to say, I read an article not that long ago about the Beatles that said that they would try to only add things if they thought they were necessary. Like, everything that you ever heard in a Beatles song was there because they wanted it.
Yeah, you should be there. Like, yeah. You shouldn't just be throwing crap at a song just because you want to layer it. It should be there.
And even the noisy, really noisy stuff I listen to, like Melt Banana or Godflesh or something like that.
Yeah, it's necessary.
It's
yeah.
not that much layering. It's not that much instrumentation. It's just noisy.
It's like I brought up earlier, like Swans. That new Swans record's great. That's layered, and it's all necessary. It's awesome. Beautiful wall. It's like a wall of sound, like My Bloody Valentine. I don't think any of their noise is, like, unnecessary. It's part of the track. It needs to be there.
Well, exactly. Like the old Southern Death Cult stuff was like, like I said, it's like in a cave or something. Like, and it was huge. And it really wasn't even, like, high fidelity, really. Like, it was sort of lo-fi.
Cave rock.
Yeah.
Now, Cheerless Town, together with what sounds like a Pharisa organ and the fact that it's actually the longest track on the album, that really gives this one a sort of a, like, we were talking about that late 60s, early 70s classic rock feel, man. There's more of the same on Eddie Annan as well, which, again, yours, with that ubiquitous organ and that guitar tone. So, to that point, what's with all the 60s psychedelic rock influences here? Because it's all over the album. I mean, it's a very different feel from the first Sono Morte record. I actually think I like the EP better in that respect, because they're both extremely evocative and haunting, but Revival's atmospheric in a different way. You know, the first one seemed to over bigger depth of something like Fields of the Nephilim, for example.
Well, Crank and I, we were, I think when we were kicking around ideas, I got this crappy, I'm trying to see it now. Is it a Yamaha keyboard up here? And we were kicking around ideas, and we were sitting around recording stuff that we thought like maybe useful or whatever. And then he was working on those big, like, you know, church organs at his house or whatever. And we were throwing things back and forth. And what was it? We recorded something, and it...
Well, we tried some different... Before we settled on the organ, we tried some different things. I don't even remember, like an old Oberheim kind of sound, like 50 kind of sound.
Yeah.
And we were just messing around with stuff like that, but kind of seemed to work out or gel very well.
Well, right. Originally, the one thing that he gave me, the keyboard part to... he gave me the keyboard part to Etienne, and then I threw the original lyrics were just like this completely hippy-trippy...
Green apples in the sand.
Yeah, green apples in the sand on the shore of Elysian, I don't know. It was like this weird, bizarre, like, acid trip, like...
And like candy source?
Yeah.
very 60s psych kind of 60s stuff.
Psych hardcore. And you know where it comes from is just honestly I'm like immersed in that kind of stuff, you know, so like that's what I listen to. And I mean, that's not all I listen to. I mean, I listen to, like you were saying, I listen to, you know, Racer X and everything else too, but I mean, I actually seek that kind of stuff out. Like I seek out
H.P. Lovecraft and People and, you know, that kind of stuff too.
Old
Strawberry
Bizarre
Alarm Clock.
Alarm Clock, yeah. But yeah, so
it's funny that you talk, like bringing up the organ thing. I remember when we went in to record, Chris, you were just like, listen, I'm obsessed with this organ. This organ is going to be on every song in one form or another. Right?
It was.
It was. You were just like, I can't get enough thing this time. And it fits perfectly with Brian's stuff because it goes right in with anything that has like a 70s type vibe. It's perfect.
I just love that Leslie grind that those old organs had. Like it sort of oscillates on itself. And
I mean, I think, well, you know, like the old Alice Cooper stuff is has a heavy influence on me too. But it's like, I could be wrong, but I don't hear a difference between the early 80s goth and late 60s and then all through the 70s prog stuff. I don't hear, I mean, I hear like a small...
The biggest difference is heroin.
Now, in some ways, I think that Revival's a stronger project, even though it's a much shorter one. You know, it certainly gets your attention faster. You know, Son of Mori kind of grows on you with repeated listenings. It may be stronger in the long run, but Revival's catchier in the short term. So is that deliberate?
No. Part of it's, I mean, you know, there's years apart between these things. So we've all been doing things in the meantime, so we've gotten better at what we do, really and collectively. I think part of it with the Revival EP is the sound. The first album, I still like the sound of the first album, but it's a little muddy. There's some weird things I did that I wouldn't do now.
Well, I remember the odd thing about the first album was that we went out of our way to do a lot of the recordings on the instruments we used. Like, I used, some dead strings. We used, like, stuff that was, because the whole idea was this ghostly thing. So I was like, all right, well, I got this guitar that's kind of, you know, neck bent and the strings are old. And here's this old-ass keyboard. And we even did things like, which this was profound to me, was the intro is Chris's godfather, who passed away years ago. We used the old guitar bit that he put on a four track. Was it right? Four track.
Well, no, he had he would record himself with practice stuff, and I put together a bunch of different takes of a practice thing that he was working on, and that became the rhythm track to the opening and the reprise.
Yeah. And the first album we did in such a I don't know, the whole spirit of it was like, it's hard to describe. Like, I mean, like there's certain parts in one of the songs you can even hear the chair I'm sitting in squeaks because I turned. We kept that in. Weird stuff like that.
Brian and his wife used to have a parrot.
You can hear the parrot in the background screaming.
At one point you hear the parrot going.
Yeah, and on the EP we didn't do anything like that. We actually were like, all right, let's use the instruments that we actually use instead of like using these old beat up things. And the EP was done super quick, yeah. The full length we did, because Chris was in Chicago, we did the whole chunk of it, and then we waited like maybe 6 months? It was from July till November is when he came here, and then we finished it up.
Not to belabor the point, but it is worth mentioning that intro thing, which is actually, I think, sort of original and different, the intro and then the Tim's theme off of the first album, was posthumous. That guy actually has been passed away for, 10, 15 years now?
Yeah, about 8 years, I think.
And, I mean, it's like, that was something that he recorded, and Chris sort of, like, manipulated it to work into it.
Put keyboards on it and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost like... That's
it's like we had a ghost playing on the album.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's...
Woo!
Ultimate expression of how this project is, like... together, you know, something that was recorded like 15 years earlier, you know.
Yeah, the whole right. The whole feel of the first one was kind of like, let's even, that's why I mentioned like having old guitars. It was like, let's use these things that are, they're gone. Things that probably should they, you know, this is a new record, so it shouldn't technically be on here, but it will be on here because.
In effect, you guys were almost practicing magic there. You know, you're kind of doing the sympathetic thing where you're just like, okay, this is what we want to draw forth, and we're going to pull, all right, here's a piece of, you know, this kind of archival thing, and here's a piece of this history, and this thing from this dead person, and here's this broken thing that's been there for however many years, and this is what we're going to evoke with it. Was that deliberate at all?
It was a pretty organic kind of construct, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm.
So, well, if I do again, because Brian's got these old-ass violins that are awesome. I'm looking at them right now. Chris was messing with one earlier. They're so old, they sound terrible, but if you put them over top of something else, it's going to sound really whacked out.
Yeah,
it's going to sound really weird and eerie.
We're getting like Celtic Frost territory.
Into the pandemonium, what needs to be done.
So, Brian, are Chemo's Crown and Condemned the only tracks you actually take a guitar solo on? Because there's a lot more organ and lead guitar on this EP.
I think that's the only two I played. Yeah, I don't think I played even guitar on anything else. I didn't play the guitar on Cumulus Crown. I only did the vocals, and then I did the solo on Condemned, and then I did all the guitar and the bass and the vocals on Cumulus Crown. But
yeah, Cumulus Crown, you did all the guitar stuff on.
Right. That and that was something that I wrote, that actual guitar riff for Cumulus Crown. I went back to my old cassette, like my actual cassette tapes, and found an instrumental that I wrote in like 92, and I had to actually, it was like a metal kind of like instrumental. I found it, and I was scanning through my old tapes, and I was like, well, if I turn this into an acoustic type thing, I could probably use this for the underlying rhythm. So actually, I wrote that rhythm track in like 92.
Wow. Now, Condemned has more than a dash of Ghost Riders in the Sky to it, with some other latter day Johnny Cash thrown in for good measure, like that last record you put out with Rick Rubin on American. You know, it definitely delivers a bleak atmosphere that fits the whole farmland setting.
Yeah, what's weird, Condemned, I wrote that in 2000, in the year 2000, and just finally now made it onto the record. And that, the only reason I even wrote that song was because I was sitting at home and watching the Woodstock movie, and the song Freedom came on, which I love that song.
Yes.
And I was like, what would be the opposite of that song? Would be Condemned.
Yeah.
And I actually remember I wrote that song probably as long as it takes to play it. It was like immediate, one of those immediate type songs, 15 years ago.
Even more so along the same lines, A Message from Absalom. That song in particular conveys a desolate feel like Danzig's End of Time off the first album. But, you know, I just think you should have used a silver tone with vibrato like Chris Isaak or something, because there's something akin to that kind of sound and feel there.
Well, Message from Absalom was actually, it was kind of a complete accident. I had, when I was doing the acoustic guitar for the intro track, that plucky kind of 50s thing, I couldn't actually play the fingering. I couldn't switch from one to the other correctly.
Right.
So I tuned the guitar in such a way that it made it conducive for me to do that. Completely a weird tuning, like not even a standard anything. But while I was doing that, since I had it in that tuning, I decided to mess around with some things, just kind of around it. And I came up with the acoustic line for A Message to Absalom for that. And everything else just kind of fell in place behind that. But if I wouldn't have had to tune the guitar in such a weird way, that probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking, I just wish they'd make this into a movie, because in the right hands, it'd be like a great 80s-style slasher zombie picture, you know, across between the Halloween films and Dead and Buried.
Yeah, they there was some rumor about it going around, getting developed as a television show.
Yeah, Revival might be a show, maybe.
Wow.
But in the meantime, there's something else that came up that was similar to, I don't know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. Yeah.
So we're working on the third one now. We're actually working on the fourth one, because the third would be the season two of Revival, and then we're working on another full length, which the working title is, what is it? It's The Strange Death and Afterlife of Ruby Bishop.
Sounds good to me. That works.
And it's a concept album.
Yeah, another kind of movie story.
I think this one might be a little more succinct, though, based on what I've written. I sort of undertook writing the main storyline, I guess. Crank and I sort of like kicked it back and forth. But
now, I don't know if this is true anywhere, but I know at the time that we talked originally, it hadn't actually been released as a physical CD at that point. You know, it was only available via download from the Son of Mori Bandcamp.com and through CD Baby. So why did you choose to release that way?
Well, Mostly because it didn't seem like it was worth it. It didn't seem like it was financially worth it, I guess, at the time to try to release a physical copy of stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff's moving towards digital things anyway. Even if you buy a CD half the time, you just put it in your computer long enough to encode it and download it to your
What's the real time? It isn't very long.
It's like 20-something minutes.
I remember we were talking about if we accumulated enough money from it, we would press it on vinyl with the picture disc or something like that, and that'd be the end of it.
Yeah, ideally, if it actually... You know, at some point, if we ever actually made a physical copy of it, I'd love to make a vinyl copy of it. Cause that's,
with the front cover on the vinyl?
Again, with
creepy the... Creepy out with the little girl spinning.
And again, with, like I said, I get into those weird collector things. I'm in the middle of a vinyl stuff. But CDs, they seem sort of ephemeral to me at this point. They're not really... You buy them as a medium. Like, you know, like a point between getting it, you know, into your MP3 player of choice or whatever.
Right. Now, all I got to say, though, is that the album is too damn short. I mean, it's so good, but it ends so quickly. It actually reminds me in that respect of the first Danzig record. You know, it's the sort of thing you pull out every fall. And it's very much like, again, it's late September, Halloween into November sort of an album. It's grim and moody without being utterly despairing. And then you've got this chugging sort of an undertone, almost like a throbbing drone throughout that makes it feel very cinematic. There's music that you sing along to, and there's music where you just shut up and watch the visions come. And this is definitely from the latter school of thought.
Cool.
Thanks.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it sounds, that's a great compliment.
I think we tend to fall into a fall-winter vibe
yeah.
a lot of times anyway, because it's just sort of, what do you want to say, it's sort of a theme? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's just so much talk of death, so you get the death of nature and then the kind of thing, so it's kind of all...
We don't get a lot of spring-summer. Like, you know,
we don't have the spring album yet.
We don't have that summer sing-along kind of thing going on. You know?
Wait,
the whole Death of the Old King, Rise of the Holly King thing. So, yeah, and again, we were talking about all along, it's almost like instrumental music or the best soundtrack music. Outside of the Italians, I guess the closest point of reference for people here would be the early John Carpenter films, you know, that sort of throbbing, intense, instantly memorable minimalism he put out with soundtracks for, like, The Fog, Halloween, Escape from New York, that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Carpenter's a big influence on me, too. That dun, dun, dun.
I love John Carpenter. I think so many, especially, I mean, I'm diehard like I am with any artist I like, so I'll say I like all of his stuff. But I would
I don't really like Mars, the soundtrack of that.
Ghost of Mars? Ghost of Mars is a weak movie.
Weird, like, new metal.
I know, but I would say Mouth of Madness back is all gold. That's great.
That's true. That's true. And that's the case with most of his movies, too, if you discount The Children of the Damned, which was a real misstep.
Yeah, but you know what? It's one of them deals where I'm like, well, it's Carpenter, so I'm going to buy it. And I'll watch it from time to time. It isn't horrible.
Honestly,
it's just not very good.
I'll watch Ghost of Mars, too.
I've seen Ghost of Mars more times than I should have.
Probably.
And and then we got the weird one that his name's not even on.
That recent one.
No, the old one. Memoirs of the Invisible Man with Chevy Chase. That's John Carpenter.
That's Carpenter.
He just doesn't have his name on it. Yeah, it's horrible, but it's John Carpenter. It's Chevy Chase. Well, that doesn't really sell the point, does it?
The hospital thing?
His last movie was the chick running around in the asylum, which was decent. What was that called?
It wasn't horrible. Yeah, it was was it called The Asylum? It wasn't called The Asylum.
No, I'm drawing a blank here.
Yeah, I just go through Mouth of Madness, and then the only other exception I've seen since then that was like, okay, yeah, this is almost like a comeback, was that thing he did for Showtime, the Cigarette Burns.
Cigarette Burns is killer.
That was from Masters of Horror?
Yeah, the first one. The second one I liked, it's nuts, Pro-Life with the Demon.
I didn't even see that.
Where Ron Perlman won't let his daughter get an abortion, even though she's saying she's been raped by a demon, and then it ends up being true. That's crazy because the monster looked... I mean, it's cool, but it looks older. I mean, it looks like something from, like, 10 years before his big monsters walk around, where's my baby at?
So, at this point, do you guys want to give the listeners your Facebook page, your website information?
We don't have a Cerno Morte Facebook page, but we do have a Vladimir's Facebook page, and I guess it would probably be, like, something like facebook.com/Vladimir's. I don't even know. There was something I was going to sort of like...
You're super proactive, huh?
Yeah. I think there's actually a Cerno Morte... Oh, there's a Cerno Morte MySpace thing. It's probably MySpace/Cerno Morte. I don't know.
Hey, MySpace just got bought up by Justin Timberlake, so...
Well...
So, gold. Profit equals profit.
I would say, I guess the most as far as like being direct with Cerno Morte, I guess probably Bandcamp sonofmorty.com.
Yeah, that's sonofmorty.bandcamp.com.
Right.
That's where anything new is going to pop up.
Yeah.
Eventually, I'm going to get the first album up on there, so I just haven't done it yet.
I'm thinking that maybe if we do this part two to Revival, maybe we'll like couple the two together, and maybe there'll be a CD release for that, maybe? I don't know.
Not a bad idea.
And then the newest, like, full length will be that, The Strange and, what's it going to be called?
Strange Life and Afterlife. Or
Strange Life.
Something like that. I don't know. Ruby Bishop. Get on that. We're working on it.
It's going to be something about Ruby Bishop, which is not a reference to the old jazz woman Ruby Bishop, but.
It might be.
Maybe. Okay. Maybe. But that's a definite concept album, and I've got it worked out, and all my parts are going to sound like 1970s prog and psych stuff. I've already got it demoed, and it's going to be great. There's going to be an actual vocal canon part that I'm doing, like a whole song like that. So.
And there might have cannons on the album. We don't know.
There could be cannons on the album. Chris is a Thorian actor, so it actually could be.
And we've got the whole new Vladimir's album written. It's just a matter of recording it.
Awesome.
We're waiting on Ash on that one.
It's pretty ripping brutal metal, too.
Some of it. Some of it's weird.
Slayer-esque stuff on there, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that all should be sometime this year, hopefully.
Everything will be this year. It will be the year of us.
So with that, Brian, Marky, Crank, I'd like to thank you guys for joining me here again on Third Eye Cinema. And you know I'd love to have you back on to talk to your next Vladimir's or Sono Morty album. It's always a pleasure. And someday I'll take you up on that offer and head out to Ohio and jam with you guys.
You should.
Yeah, you can stay here with us. And also, real quick, I was going to say, if it's okay, I could throw in Crank and I got and Donnie here, who are my next-door neighbor, a friend of mine. He plays drums. We got a project hopefully coming out soon called Black with Stars, but it'll be like somewhat of a, I guess, stoner metal kind of thing or whatever. So be on the lookout for that.
So, yeah, I mean, if you guys have got anything else you want to get out there, you know, we got about 2 minutes left. So, you know, go ahead and roll with it.
I got a separate solo project with the drummer from the Vladimir's, Ash Thomas, you know, the drummer from the Vladimir's, and Estuary. We're doing a thing. I think I'm going to entitle it Embattled. It's going to be like a straight-up new wave of British heavy metal kind of EP thing. Yeah, I already did a cover of a Saxon song, and I've got that recorded and everything. So,
wow.
But, yeah, so we got a whole bunch of stuff going on.
All right. So, you know, like I said, looking forward to you guys, any new projects you put out, because everything that I hear I like. So you can't say that about too many bands.
Thanks a lot, man. Take care.
Yeah, we appreciate you giving us the time to expose ourselves on your show.
Hey,
anytime.
Not like that.
Yeah, that does sound wrong. But no, anytime. It's always a pleasure, and you guys are loads of fun. You make for a good interview.
Cool. Thanks, man.
You have a good night, man.
All right, you too.
Cheers.
Take care.
See ya.
And to close out our interview with Sono Morty, we have another track off Revival. Stay tuned after the close for one more from the band, but right now this is Undying Mystery.
You don't know.
Cinema, Brian Lawrence of Dream Death, back with his first new album after 25 years. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, musician, and would like to join us on the air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema, brought to you by the Big Top Online Network, on 5-12-3. From Marky Brian and Crank. This is Written in Blood Red.
Thank you.
If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And next week...
This is Brian Lawrence from Dream Death, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Huge savings on new and previously leased furnishings. That's right, huge savings. At Court Furniture Clearance Center, choose from our wide variety of new and previously leased furniture and decor for your home or office. You'll find sofas from $199.99 and more. Everything in our 9,000 square foot showroom is Court certified, guaranteed, and in stock, ready for delivery or to take home today. Visit our Chantilly Court Furniture Clearance Center at 13946 Lee Jackson Memorial Highway or go online at courtclearancefurniture.com. Mention Radio 20 and get 20% off.